Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, May 19th, 2022. With the cost of gasoline hitting another record high in the United States, House Representatives passing a bill to give regulators authority to prosecute gas price gouging. FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf says steps the federal government is taking to deal with the national infant formula shortage, including use of the Defense Production Act, will start to get more formula into mothers' and caretakers' hands within days, but getting back to normal will take a few weeks. Senate approving a $40 billion aid package for Ukraine provides more military, economic, and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine in its fight to repel Russia's invasion. It took a week because one senator held up the vote, Republican Rand Paul. President Joe Biden welcoming the leaders of Finland and Sweden to the White House, giving his endorsement to their applications to join the NATO military alliance, bids that they submitted, they say, due to the potential threat from Russia. And President Biden starting a trip to Asia, his first as president, visits to Japan and South Korea. We'll talk about it with Washington Post White House reporter Tyler Pager. Average price of a gallon of gasoline in the U.S. reaching a new record high today, $4.59, according to AAA. It's up 12 cents since Monday. J.P. Morgan analysts predicting $6 a gallon or more for gasoline this summer. On the U.S. House floor today in Washington, a bill to prohibit oil companies from charging excessive prices during a presidentially declared energy emergency and giving the Federal Trade Commission the power to prosecute those who do charge those prices. Congressman Frank Pallone, Democrat from New Jersey, is chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, managing the bill on the House floor.
This legislation is necessary right now because big oil companies are ripping off the American people. At a time when Americans are paying record high prices for gas, big oil is taking advantage of the instability caused by Russia's unjust war in Ukraine and our ongoing economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic to rake in record profits. The largest four big oil companies collectively made $27 billion in profits during the first quarter of this year. And some of these were record highs, others were the highest profits in over a decade. One CEO was so giddy about these profits, Madam Speaker, that he said his company was, and I quote, a cash machine. These companies are indeed cash machines. Last month, the Energy and Commerce Committee held a hearing with the leaders of the six big oil companies, and during that hearing and questioning from me, all six big oil CEOs refused to scale down stock buybacks, making it abundantly clear that their sole interest is their profits, even when it comes at the expense of the American people. Instead of a traditional supply and demand economic model where we'd expect to see these companies ramping up production to meet rising demand, they are instead using their profits to buy back their own stock to further pad the pockets of their executives and shareholders.
Congressman Frank Pallone, chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee on the House floor. Later in his statement, he went through the details of the bill that the members would be voting on.
The bill grants the president the power to declare an energy emergency proclamation and makes it illegal to sell consumer fuels at an excessive and exploitative price during an energy emergency. The Federal Trade Commission would then be empowered to go after fuel wholesalers and retailers, both wholesalers and retailers, for price gouging. It also empowers state attorney generals, including the U.S. territories and the District of Columbia, to enforce against price gouging at the retail level. Now, this legislation bolsters FTC's ability to crack down on fuel market manipulation and doubles the maximum penalty for manipulating wholesale oil markets to up to $2 million a day for each violation. It also includes provisions that would improve market transparency and competition, which is so important since a large portion of the oil and gas pricing is done in the dark.
Democratic Congressman Frank Pallone, chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee on the House floor. The ranking Republican on that committee is Kathy McMorris Rogers from Washington State.
Gas prices surpassed $4 a gallon in every state for the first time ever and are predicted to hit $6 a gallon this summer. Let's come together. Let's come together and unleash American energy and continue to lead on reducing carbon emissions. We can do both. Instead, today the majority is pursuing government price controls on energy prices while continuing to shut down American energy. This combination will only make prices and inflation worse. This scheme comes directly from the playbook of socialist dictators. Look at places like Soviet Russia, Venezuela, North Korea. These are the countries that have imposed government price controls. Well, actually, the United States of America tried this in the 70s. We tried this approach, and the result? Shortages, rationing, mile-long lines for gas. It was an economic and humanitarian crisis. And now again, the majority wants to impose de facto government price controls. This bill gives President Biden sweeping powers to declare an energy emergency. We're living right now under a public health emergency. It's frightening to me. And it would arm the FTC with tools to impose de facto arbitrary caps on mom-and-pop gas stations for prices of fuel such as gasoline, diesel, and propane. It's not going to bring down the price of gas, and it will only cause further shortages like we experienced in the 1970s. And yet, even now, President Biden is doubling down as he continues to shut down American energy. He placed a moratorium on new drilling, canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, supported canceling oil leases in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. And this week, it's reported that he is moving to ease the energy sanctions on Venezuela. The United States of America is the leading producer of oil and gas. It's cleaner and abundant. American workers and companies are eager to start producing more at home. Why are we increasing energy imports from places like Venezuela to offset the disastrous results of shutting down American energy?
Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers on the House floor. The House went on to pass this bill to outlaw excessive energy prices and allow the federal government to go after companies that do charge them. The vote was 217 to 207, all the yes votes coming from Democrats, the no votes coming from Republicans and four Democrats, Stephanie Murphy of Florida, Lizzie Fletcher of Texas, Kathleen Rice from New York, and Jared Golden from Maine. The bill now heads to the Senate. From the Wall Street Journal, regulators plan to propose a new five-year schedule of lease sales for offshore oil and gas drilling by June 30th, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland said Thursday during a budget hearing. Oil and gas companies have been frustrated by delays in the rollout of a new program and now face a blackout period of an uncertain amount of time on new lease sales for drilling spots off the U.S. coastline when the current schedule expires on June 30th. Ms. Haaland said her agency would finish a new proposal by then, but didn't immediately outline when the proposal will be adopted as a final plan. Reporting from the Wall Street Journal, we covered this hearing, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Both the chairman, Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and the ranking Republican, John Barrasso of Wyoming, asking her about this. First, Senator Barrasso.
You announced that the department will release a proposed five-year plan on offshore oil and gas leases. You are way behind schedule, not provided any details on the plan. 2 weeks ago, the Senate voted to support my motion to finalize a new five-year plan by June of 2022. Well, that's coming up in about 6 weeks. My motion requires that the new plan to include robust leasing with at least 10 region-wide lease sales off of Alaska in the Gulf of Mexico with a minimum of 2 sales per calendar year. Now, a large majority of this committee, both sides of the aisle, voted for it and it passed the Senate. Will you finalize a new 5-year plan by this date that the Senate in a bipartisan way is recommending that includes at least 10 region-wide sales off of Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico with at least 2 sales per year?
Ranking Member, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, we are working on the process and we have been working on that process. There was, the process was stopped in 2018, as I mentioned, so there was a lot to catch up on. I will be happy to, we'll run a transparent process. We'll do what's required through the law, and we are happy to keep you updated as to the progress that we're making on the five-year plan.
Well, thank you, because, Mr. Chairman, the administration can't have it both ways. The administration can't pretend to support oil and gas production while doing everything in their power to slow down and block expanded production on public lands. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. And I'll go with my questions next, if you don't mind. I would like to ask the same thing and follow up. Onshore and offshore, all we're asking for, can you commit to doing the leasing? I know you're going to do the plan, what we're committed to is the leasing that goes with it, because there's no guarantee that's going to happen on either onshore or offshore. And if you can't answer, I understand where I have to get the answer from. If you can, is your intent to lease?
Thank you, Chairman. Our intent is to follow the law. We know that this five-year plan is in the works right now. I couldn't tell you if I tried what is in it at the moment.
Let me just, if I can, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but never before has there not been a lease that I know of. When the plan was put forward, it was put forward with the intent to lease, and it was followed up with leasing. You seem to be hesitant, and I understand. I'm not trying to put you in a tough spot. I just want to know, is the administration, with you have your top people with you right now, is your intent to lease unless you're stopped from leasing?
Chairman, we have continued to lease. Thank you. We have continued to lease, and in fact, and I won't mention the permits because I know that isn't something you want to hear, but the truth be told, right now, currently, onshore, there are more than 12 million acres under lease. Offshore, more than 8 million acres under lease. It's clear that we are leasing.
Well, those have been previous, but the bottom line is that you have the ability to make some of the changes as we've recommended. There's practical changes that should have been made by now. You don't need us. You can look at and review it, and if we think you're out of bounds, then we'll pull you back in. But we think that basically there needs to be adjustment in a lease program. Private sector understands it. A lot of leases they're holding, they shouldn't be holding, but they will if they're as cheap as they are. So there's a lot of adjustments that can be made. We're not making any attempt. I'm not going to belabor this anymore.
Senator Joe Manchin, chair of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, Democrat from West Virginia, questioning the Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. And before that, you heard from the ranking Republican on the committee, Senator John Barrasso from Wyoming. Reuters covering the hearing, writing, the Interior Department is required by law to produce a five-year schedule of offshore oil and gas auctions. The administration earlier this month scrapped the current plan's last three planned sales in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. Department last held an oil and gas auction for the Gulf of Mexico in November, but a court order later vacated that sale, saying the administration had failed to properly account for its impact on climate change. This is Washington Today. Now to the issue of infant formula shortage across the nation. This from WashingtonPost.com. Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf told lawmakers that his agency has been working tirelessly to increase supplies of baby formula nationally, and that he expects an Abbott nutrition plant in Michigan that made much of the country's formula to be operating again within 2 weeks. Here's part of Dr. Califf's opening statement before a House Appropriations Subcommittee.
The United States was facing infant formula supply chain stress even before the Abbott Nutrition recall that began in February. The pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and labor supply issues have all had an impact, and I can assure you FDA has been working tirelessly to address this issue. This week, we've set up a mechanism that streamlines the ability for companies that do not normally sell infant formula in this country to do so, and provides other flexibilities to domestic distributors who can help increase availability. I want to be clear, under this process, an infant formula would only be imported after the agency reviews the product and determines the product is safe and provides adequate nutrition. Safety is paramount. In addition, a consent decree, a permanent injunction, was entered between the FDA and Abbott Nutrition. Under the consent decree, Abbott has agreed to take actions overseen by FDA and independent experts that will result in an increase of infant formula products and ensure safe powdered infant formula is produced at the facility. As you also know, yesterday the President invoked the Defense Production Act to ensure that manufacturers have the necessary ingredients to make safe, healthy infant formula here at home, and announced Operation Fly Formula to speed up the import of infant formula to stores as soon as possible. Again, we know many parents and caregivers are feeling frustrated. With these three recent actions, we anticipate that additional products can quickly hit U.S. stores.
The FDA Commissioner, Dr. Robert Califf, opening statement before a House Appropriations Subcommittee. Another paragraph from the Washington Post story on this hearing. The FDA has been criticized for moving too slowly to investigate a whistleblower complaint last year at that Abbott facility, which was inspected and shuttered only this year after two infants were sickened and two infants died after consuming contaminated formula. Abbott has said there isn't clear evidence that contamination came from the factory. Back to the hearing, Congressman David Valadao, Republican from California, questioning Dr. Califf.
I believe all of us here on the committee are hearing from our constituents about the dire infant formula situation. Between the infant formula recall, subsequent plant shutdown, ongoing supply chain disruptions, and people panic buying out of fear that they won't be able to feed their babies, this has become a dangerous and unacceptable situation. Low-income and disadvantaged communities like many in my district are suffering from consequences of the recall that started 3 months ago, or closer to 4 months ago. These families have been suffering through the COVID-19 pandemic, ongoing supply chain issues, inflation, and more, and they need a break. This administration appears interested in alleviating the issue, but it's taken too long to get to this point. We must ensure the shortage is fixed immediately. As you well know, especially on this committee, recalls of products in our country is not a new thing. And when it comes to this vital, something as vital as the children's food supply, it seems the FDA just did not take this one as seriously as they should have. This isn't about purchasing a popular, trendy type of infant formula. This is about a critical access to specific formulas parents and caregivers need for their babies. Even one of my own children was relying on a very specific type of formula. So as a father who has had the opportunity or been in a situation where I had to drive all over town to chase specific formulas, and this was far before any shortage, I could only imagine the stress these parents are experiencing. Did the FDA treat this just like every other or any other recall that they've had to deal with, or did they understand the gravity of the situation from the beginning? More importantly, do they now fully grasp how devastating this entire situation has been and continues to be?
Well, I thank you for raising the, you know, specific issues of concern. From day one, when we saw the problems with the Abbott plant, we knew that this was a critical plant for the supply chain, and the team was meeting on a very regular basis trying to figure out how to manage the situation, hoping to keep the plant open with better quality measures. And then it became clear that was not going to work, and we had a period of time of having to reach a consent decree, which is a complicated legal proceeding. But as I've indicated, we're all very aware. Many of us are parents or grandparents. Many of us have relatives that are in the same situation. We're hearing from everyone, so we're very focused.
I appreciate that. And we're limited on time, obviously. So I hope that you understand that this is something that is having a huge impact. And obviously, people all over the country are struggling with this. We're here in 2 weeks, and I know that the chairwoman had mentioned that that we want to see this open. I'd like to know what the FDA is doing on the ground at the Abbott plant in Michigan to help the situation as much as they possibly can. Are they working with them? Are folks on the ground as we speak right now making sure that we can get this facility up and running?
We're working with Abbott every day, and I'm getting a report twice a day, in the morning and the evening, about the progress that's being made. I mean, recognize we're just on day three now. But it looks like it is going well, that Abbott has remediated a number of the issues, and we're going to make sure it gets done as quickly as it possibly can.
Dr. Robert Califf, the FDA commissioner, questioned by Congressman David Valadao at today's House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. Back to the Washington Post article, they write, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, expressed concerns about the FDA's looser guidance for foreign infant formula manufacturers, expressing concern that in the name of increasing domestic supplies of formula, unsafe formula would be introduced from abroad. Here's a portion of that exchange at today's hearing.
In the guidance that you put forward, you list recommended, but not required information from the manufacturers, and the manufacturers are most likely are not FDA approved. You have seven FDA approved facilities, which you could go to immediately, but what you're talking about in the guidance is that you list recommendations that are not required to be followed. And so, in fact, they do not even have to include those your recommendations in their application for certification and for review. Will you commit to not exercising enforcement discretion with respect to critical statutory and regulatory safety requirements?
Yes, with an emphasis on those critical requirements. We will not let infant formula into the U.S. It is not safe.
Well, but these folks do not have to abide by your recommendations. It is a guidance. Nothing is required of these potential manufacturers. Nothing.
With due respect, Madam Chairwoman, you're correct in what you say, except that we have the authority to either let the product in or not. So we have control over that.
Well, if you've got somebody who certifies, and you also talk in your guidance that people and efforts can self-certify or have a third party certify, so that you in fact do not have the tangible evidence from these facilities that in fact their product is safe to be imported, that baby formula is safe. I just want you to commit to the safety portion of this effort, and you don't have in place a mechanism that would guarantee the safety right now. You just don't. That guidance does not allow you to determine and to define the safety of the products that may be coming from facilities that are not FDA approved. And why aren't we going to facilities that are FDA approved and not allowing all these other potential manufacturers to enter into our system with the potential of creating another crisis.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut. She chairs the full House Appropriations Committee. At a subcommittee hearing today, testimony from the FDA Commissioner, Dr. Robert Califf. You can find the full event at our video library at cspan.org. The House Wednesday night passed two bills aimed at alleviating the infant formula shortage, and one of them has already passed the Senate, heading to President Biden's desk for his signature. That one deals with the federal program that aids low-income women, infants, and children, the WIC program, allowing them to buy any formula brand rather than a specific brand, which may not be available. The House vote Wednesday night was 414-9. The Senate vote today was voice vote, unanimous. The other bill that passed the House Wednesday night would provide $28 million to the FDA to help increase supply and prevent future shortages by increasing staffing there. A vote on that was 231-192, with 12 Republicans joining the Democrats to pass it. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby saying the Defense Department is starting to implement the president's directive to contract commercial planes to bring infant formula into the U.S. from other countries, that mission named Operation Fly Formula.
On to the news last night about support for the baby formula crisis here in the country. U.S. Transportation Command is expeditiously coordinating across federal agencies to include the Departments of Agriculture and Health and Human Services and the Food and Drug Administration to support the president's direction to conduct Operation Fly Formula. U.S. Transportation Command will leverage its partnership with commercial air carriers to contract and accelerate the importation of infant formula into the United States that meets our government's health and safety standards. Now, we're in this active coordination right now. I do not have a specific flight to speak to today or exact quantities to speak to today. We are in active coordination with the interagency. We've got our marching orders, and we'll work through this. The first step of that is, again, working with the interagency to identify locations where formula can be had overseas and then getting the right aircraft in place to bring that to the United States, and then, of course, working out the destination. So I'm sure you all have a lot of questions about this. We are in the very early stages of working through this. We all share the same sense of urgency, and we will participate and cooperate to the best of our ability, but I just don't have like specific aircraft information to give you today.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby with reporters in the Pentagon briefing room. Wall Street today, the Dow down 236, NASDAQ down 29, S&P down 22. The Vaccine Advisory Board at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has voted in favor of recommending COVID-19 vaccine boosters for children ages 5 to 11. The vote of the advisory board, 11 to 4. The FDA signed off on this a couple of days ago. Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, the only one approved for this age group. With the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky's okay, the shots could be given out as early as this weekend. And the Labor Department says applications for unemployment benefits rose last week by 21,000 to 218,000, but the total number of Americans collecting unemployment benefits still at a 53-year low. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. The U.S. Census Bureau says in the 2020 census, six states had significant undercounts, ranging from about 2% to 5% of the population missed. Arkansas, Florida, Illinois, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Texas. And eight states had significant overcounts, from about 2% to almost 7% missed. In the other direction, Delaware, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New York, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Utah. For Florida and Texas, those undercounts appear to have cost them congressional seats. And for Minnesota and Rhode Island, the overcounts appear to have saved them from losing those seats. Justice Department announcing a reversal of a 2014 policy about bringing charges for violations of a federal computer fraud law. Now, there will not be prosecutions for accessing a computer solely for purposes of good faith testing, investigation, and or correction of a security flaw or vulnerability without any intention of harming the public. USA Today reporting the Senate Thursday approved more than $40 billion of additional humanitarian and military assistance for Ukraine as the last aid package was expected to run out this week. The bill, which now heads to President Joe Biden for his signature, is triple the amount of aid the U.S. has already committed to the war-torn country trying to beat back Russia's invasion. It passed 86 to 11, with most Republicans joining every Democrat in approving the bill. A statement of support on the Senate floor. Before that vote, Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat Vermont, chair of the Appropriations Committee.
It's a shame that because of the actions of one senator, we could not pass this urgently needed bill, which is going to receive overwhelmingly bipartisan support, that we couldn't have passed it last week. To confront Vladimir Putin on the global stage, we have to stand united. Now, later tonight, I'm going to be leading a delegation to Brussels. And tomorrow we will receive an update from NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg on Ukraine and why the new resources provided in this bill are urgently needed. It'll be a bipartisan delegation I'm leading, but I'm going to be proud to tell the NATO Secretary General we came together in the United States and the House to pass this appropriations. The bill provides $1 billion in critical military and humanitarian assistance for Ukraine, helps defend Ukraine's sovereignty and democracy abroad, and address the rising global hunger crisis. It includes $8.5 billion in additional presidential drawdown authority for critical weapons transfer, $8.5 billion for the Economic Support Fund to respond to emerging needs in Ukraine, and over $5 billion global food aid, which the distinguished presiding officer has argued for some time. As chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and proudly as president pro tempore of this body, I strongly support its passage.
Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat, on the Senate floor. The one senator that held up passage of the bill for a week, and he and Senator Leahy referred to him, Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, who responded after the vote.
Those senators who voted to gift $40 billion to Ukraine argue that it is in our national security interest. I wonder if Americans across our country would agree if they had been shown the costs if they had been asked to pay for it. If the supporters of foreign aid for Ukraine had been honest with Americans, they could have instituted a Ukraine war tax. I'm sure it would have been quite popular. By my calculation, each income tax payer in our country would need to pay $500 to support this $40 billion, which by some accounts is a down payment and will need to be replenished in about 4 months. So a $500 tax to every American income taxpayer would pay for this. But that's not the way things are done in Washington. What we do is say, put it on my tab. We don't want to be honest. We don't want to be transparent with the taxpayer. We just add it to the debt. We could have also taken the $40 billion from elsewhere in the budget. We could have said, well, we spend $770 billion on our military, and that $770 billion is more than the next eight countries combined. We could have taken it out of our military budget. If it's in our national security interest, perhaps it could be a military expenditure. But no, we don't want to tax the people. We don't want them to know that there is a payment or a punishment for this. We don't want to take it from somewhere else where somebody else is getting rich off of this money. No, what we do is we simply borrow it. Put it on my tab is what Congress says. So yes, that's what will happen. So when Americans go to the grocery store, they will pay yet again higher prices. When Americans go to the gas pump, they will spend even more for their gas because there is no free lunch. $40 billion cannot be created out of thin air, although it sort of is by the Fed. But in being created and increasing the demand, it causes inflation. Debt leads to inflation.
Senator Rand Paul, Republican on the Senate floor. He voted no on the $40 billion Ukraine aid bill that passed today. So did 10 other Republicans. Blackburn, Bozeman, Braun, Crapo, Haggerty, Hawley, Lee, Lummis, Marshall, and Tuberville. The bill, though passed overwhelmingly, will be signed into law by President Biden. U.S. now has a Senate-confirmed ambassador to Ukraine for the first time in 3 years. Senators approving the nomination Wednesday night unanimously. Bridget Brink, career Foreign Service officer and current ambassador to Slovakia. She'll be heading to the just-reopened U.S. Embassy in Ukraine's capital city of Kyiv. President Biden hosting the leaders of Finland and Sweden today at the White House, giving his full support for their applications to join the NATO military alliance. They applied in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The three met privately in the White House Oval Office, then came out to the Rose Garden. President Biden leading off.
Today, the President, the Prime Minister, and I had a very good discussion about NATO accession, about the war in Ukraine, and strengthening transatlantic security. But our conversations began well before today. President Niinistö and I spoke last December, and again in January, and the weeks leading up to Russia's unjust and unprovoked assault on Ukraine. In March, the President came to the White House to see me, to discuss this brutal conflict and the rupture it's causing in Europe. While we were in the Oval Office together, we picked up the phone and we called the Prime Minister, and the three of us all spoke. And we spoke again last week when I invited them to come to the White House today. We have consulted closely at every stage as Sweden and Finland made their determinations. And today I am proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries, so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty. I greatly appreciate Senator Schumer and McConnell's support, as well as Senator Menendez and Risch, to move this through the Senate as quickly as possible, once the perspective of all allies are addressed and NATO adopts the accession protocols. The bottom line is simple. Quite straightforward. Finland and Sweden make NATO stronger.
President Biden with the Swedish Prime Minister and the Finnish President in the White House Rose Garden. He referred to the fact that all views of the NATO members, 30 of them currently, need to be taken into account When the president of Finland, Sauli Niinistö, made his remarks today, he mentioned objections raised by Turkey.
The Turkish leadership has recently expressed concerns about our membership application. I want to address these concerns today. Finland has always had broad and good bilateral relations to Turkey. As NATO allies, we will commit to Turkey's security just as Turkey will commit to our security. We take terrorism seriously. We condemn terrorism in all its forms, and we are actively engaged in combating it. We are open to discussing all the concerns Turkey may have concerning our membership in an open and constructive manner. These discussions have already taken place, and they will continue in the next days. 24th February, I said that the masks have fallen, and we see only the cold faces of war. Russia's war in Ukraine has changed Europe and our security environment.
The president of Finland, Sauli Niinistö, in the White House Rose Garden with the president of the United States, Joe Biden, and also the prime minister of Sweden. Turkey's approval needed for these two countries to join NATO, because any country in NATO's 30-member alliance can veto a membership bid. And the Turkish president, Erdogan, saying today, "We have told our relevant friends we would say no to Finland and Sweden's entry into NATO, and we will continue on our path like this." But the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg saying he's confident that we will come to a quick decision to welcome both Sweden and Finland to join the NATO family. President Biden leaving the White House, starting a trip to Asia, stops in Japan and South Korea scheduled. The National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan briefing reporters at the White House on Wednesday night.
A little bit about the challenges of trying to focus on the Indo-Pacific, a priority for you all from the get-go, given just, I mean, look, a bulk of the questions even here today have focused on other parts of the world. Tomorrow, Finland and Sweden are going, just the juxtaposition of what is going on in the world right now as you all are trying to focus on the Indo-Pacific.
And you know, it's interesting, we actually don't regard this as a tension between investing time, energy, and attention in Europe, and time, energy, and attention in the Indo-Pacific. We regard this as mutually reinforcing. First, look at the Indo-Pacific partners that have stepped up to help make these sanctions and export controls as effective as they are. Korea, Japan, Australia, even Singapore. Second, look at the extent to which European countries are increasingly invested in the Indo-Pacific in helping ensure that our vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific is actually realized. We see that with the AUKUS partnership, where you've got the United Kingdom alongside Australia and the United States. We see it with the way the European Union has, for the first time ever, put out an Indo-Pacific strategy. And so actually, we think that there is something quite evocative about going from meeting with the president of Finland and the prime minister of Sweden to reinforce the momentum behind the NATO alliance and the free world response in Ukraine, and getting on a plane and flying out to the Indo-Pacific, not just to deal with security issues, but to unveil a new far-reaching economic initiative, to host a Quad summit that will cover climate and cyber and emerging technologies, and to deal with Korea and Japan on issues that actually affect working people here in the United States, including major investments that will create jobs in states across the country. So for us, there is a certain level of integration and a symbiosis in the strategy we are pursuing in Europe and the strategy we're pursuing in the Indo-Pacific. And President Biden's unique capacity to actually stitch those two together is, I think, going to be a hallmark of his foreign policy presidency.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. More on President Biden's trip to Asia. Joining us on the phone is Tyler Pager, White House reporter with The Washington Post. Thank you for being on Washington Today. What is the White House saying about the goals for this trip?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And I think, you know, so much of the president's attention in recent weeks and months has been focused on Ukraine and Russia's invasion. And a big priority for the president when he ran and now in office has has been countering China's rise and building alliances in the region to really, as part of this battle between autocracy and democracy that the president has really framed his administration around. And so I think some of the goals of this trip is, one, to strengthen the alliances in the region. Obviously, he's visiting South Korea and Japan. And two, I think there's a lot of economic work that the U.S. is trying to do in the region. And so I think there's some belief that there's going to be some big announcements around the economic deals and trade deals and other initiatives that the U.S. and its allies have been working on in recent months.
President Biden, though, not going to China itself. Former President Trump did go to China on his first trip. What does that say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is... it's unlikely that I think at this moment in time, the president would step foot in China, just as it's unlikely that the Chinese leader would come to the U.S. I think, those leaders, the Chinese leader has not really left the country during the pandemic, but two, it's much more likely with an adversary that you might meet on a neutral ground, as we saw Biden and Putin met when they had their summit last summer. And it was not in the U.S. or Russia. So I think that's not surprising, given the rising tensions between the U.S. and China and the competition between the two countries.
China putting out a bit of a warning ahead of the President Biden's trip, saying that the relations between the U.S. and China could be in serious jeopardy if officials from the U.S. play the Taiwan card. What's the situation with that?
Yeah, so I think, Taiwan is something that is contested in the relationship, and then the U.S.'s recognition of it. I don't know exactly how that might manifest in this trip, but the U.S. is really hyper focused on its relationships in the region, and it's also a big part of this trip is a summit with the leaders of the so-called Quad, which is a strategic partnership the U.S. has formed in part to counter China's ascent, and that's with Australia, India, and Japan. But I think Taiwan is an issue in the region, particularly as in relation to China. Chinese leaders were quite frustrated that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had planned to go visit there. Ultimately, she didn't because she got COVID. But I do think that continues to be an issue in the relationship.
Talking with Tyler Pager with The Washington Post, also North Korea, and the possibility they could be testing something, a missile, a nuclear weapon, a provocation. How concerned is the White House about that?
I mean, I think North Korea is always a top concern for U.S. national security officials, and that remains to be the case. That will definitely be discussed as the president visits South Korea. North Korea has conducted an unprecedented number of missile tests so far this year, and China and Russia have drawn closer to North Korea as they've looked to reduce U.S. influence in the region. And so as the president heads over to Seoul, that will definitely be part of the conversation as they look to strengthen deterrence capabilities of the United States and South Korea.
And finally, it was former President Obama's administration first using that phrase, pivot to Asia, stressing the importance of the U.S. focusing on a rising power of China. It wasn't so easy for former President Obama, and now not so easy for former President Biden. How is the balance being worked out?
Right. I think that is what this whole trip is aiming to show, that Biden is making that so-called pivot to Asia. But as you noted, there are a host of foreign policy crises that have really taken the president's attention for much of his presidency so far: the withdrawal from Afghanistan, Russia's invasion in Ukraine, and that's the nature of being president, right? You don't get to pick the challenges you face. But I do think that as the president travels to Asia this week, this is going to be a big priority for him in showing that he is committed to the region and wants to work with the allies and leaders there to continue to focus on building alliances and counter China's rise.
Tyler Pager, White House reporter with The Washington Post. Find his stories at WashingtonPost.com. And on Twitter, he's at Tyler Pager. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Back to Washington, a bill to create a commission to study the creation of a National Museum of Asian Pacific American History and Culture is going to President Biden for his signature into law. The bill passed the U.S. House last month. Today, Democratic Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii asking for unanimous consent on the Senate floor to pass it there.
Asian and Pacific Islander American communities have made significant contributions to American life. But despite these undeniable contributions, our communities have largely been excluded or erased from American history. If not invisible, API groups are often pejoratively depicted as foreigners, always the other, instead of people who have lived in and positively contributed to this country for generations. These narratives have fueled xenophobia and racism, contributing to decades of racism, racist laws, and discrimination. And of course, most recently, led to the rise in attacks and hate-related incidents against members of our communities. A National Museum of Asian Pacific American History and Culture would help combat these harmful narratives by sharing API history on an unprecedented scale, and we should consider whether or not such a museum should be feasible. And with this bill, we can demonstrate our commitment to showcasing the significant contributions of the API community to our country's fabric.
Senator Mazie Hirono, Democrat from Hawaii, on the Senate floor. There was no objection, and this bill passed the Senate. It already passed the House, so it now hits President Biden for a signature to create the commission to study the creation of that National Museum of Asian Pacific American History and Culture. The commission would also decide whether the museum might be part of the Smithsonian Institution, which currently runs 19 museums in Washington, D.C. and New York City, plus the National Zoo. The commission would have 18 months to finish this study. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more of Washington's top stories sent to you every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.